This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Clinical trials are crucial. In Australia, less than 6% of cancer patients are on a clinical trial.
Every eligible Australian cancer patient should be given this opportunity. Research into any cancer can transform the field globally. It is how we will save lives across all cancers.
So if you were diagnosed with a life-threatening illness and then offered a clinical trial, what would you think? What do you actually know about clinical trials? Our two Australians of the Year, Professor Georgina Long, who you'll hear from on this program in just a little while, and Professor Richard Scollier, they're calling for more opportunities for patient clinical trials. So why are clinical trials so important? And how understood or misunderstood are clinical trials? Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning. Nick Healy joining you from ABC Shepparton. Nick, if you were offered a clinical trial, would you say yes? Like, would you, what would your reaction be?
I love this question because the answer is I don't know. I've not been in that situation, so I don't think I've had an opportunity to learn enough about them. They are a deeply mysterious kind of concept to me. I have a vague understanding from a few things I've read here and there, but I just don't feel like I know enough about them to answer that one way or the other. My other question is whether one would be available to me living where I do, outside of Melbourne, living in Shepparton. Are they around here?
That's right. And I guess the fact is you're not going to be offered or know anything about a clinical trial unless it's needed, right? And then you're already going to have an onslaught of information. You're going to be feeling hyper-stressed, even traumatised. There's lots of sort of pieces of information that you'd be trying to digest at one time. And then the idea of a clinical trial thrown at you as well, when most of us, unless you need them, don't understand a lot about clinical trials. And yes, where you live, Nick, will come into today's conversation.
It's a very important part of it. And look, even the term clinical trial sounds genuinely a bit mysterious. It seems like something that's got quite a bit of depth to it.
It needs a rebranding.
Yeah, well, no, let's not go too far, but maybe a little bit.
Well, is there a misconception around being a part of a clinical trial, that idea that it makes you a guinea pig? How experimental are they? How fundamental are they? And how understood or misunderstood are clinical trials?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you in Melbourne. Nick Healy, your co-host this morning, joining you from ABC Shepparton. Our two Australians of the Year, Nick, are calling for better access to clinical trials. We just heard a grab from Professor Richard Scollier. We'll hear from his co-director, Professor Georgina Long, in just a moment. Only 6% of cancer patients are currently on a clinical trial, and they want that number to increase.
It is a number that surprised me when I heard that back when that was first broadcast. 6% is very, very low. And given that, you know, people coming through clinical trials often say about the work it's done and the work it does with people beyond that, the research that happens within those trials, what it means to the people getting that treatment further down the road, that number seems very minimal.
Let's have a quick chat to Jane, who's in Bundoora.
Just to preface the fact that I have Lynch's syndrome, which is, a higher risk of cancers. I developed pancreatic cancer in 2015, had the big op, had the chemo, and then 6 months later was told I had 6 months to live, which was pretty shattering.
Yeah, absolutely.
I actually asked, because I'm an ex-registered nurse, well, I was still nursing at the time, about if there is any clinical trials around. And I just urge everyone to ask, because there was, I went on it, and I'm still here.
Wow.
And I'm all clear. I'm on immunotherapy still, but I'm here.
Jane, I'm really glad to hear that. But just quickly, so if you hadn't asked, obviously nothing had been offered. You hadn't been told about any trials. You had to know to ask.
That's right.
That's amazing to me. And Jane, thank you so much.
I said, is there any clinical trials around that I could go on? I didn't want more chemo because I knew that it would just stretch out the horror that was going to happen. I would prefer to just die in the 6 months and have a bit more quality of life. I said I didn't want anything that was going to stretch out the pain and suffering. I wanted cure or cure-like. That's what I said.
I'm so glad you asked that question, Jane. Thank you. We have an instant full board of calls. It's going to take some time for us to get through these calls. But whilst we do, in the studio with you this morning, Danielle Spence, who's the Head of Strategy and Support Division at the Cancer Council of Victoria, and Dr. Deshaun Hayrath from Western Health, who's the Head of Cancer Services. A warm welcome to the two of you. Danielle, you have worked within the cancer profession in so many different areas. I think the two of you have met years ago. You have extensive research in this area, but you also have, I guess, a personal connection as someone who was diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma. When you hear the term clinical trials from both a professional and from a personal perspective, how common are they? How widespread is general knowledge when it comes to clinical trials?
We talk about clinical trials in cancer care as being the gold standard because it is the way that we can test new drugs and we can test those drugs to see if they're better than what we have that's existing. And in some cases that can save lives and it can also improve people's quality of life and extend their life. For me, when I was diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma, it was one of the first questions I asked, just like your last listener, because I know to ask. And that's the challenge for people, and it's really important, and it's great that this show is raising awareness of clinical trials. We know at Cancer Council we have around 400 clinical trials in this state that we know about that are on a website that people can search for. And that's at about 40 different hospital institutions. So the clinical trials are out there and we just have to help people to have those conversations with their clinicians and their family and friends and demystify trials so that people don't think it's that guinea pig experimental, but they really can see that this trial could make a real difference for them.
Danielle, I'm keen to get into some myth-busting in a little bit, as you were just touching on then, but what do you think's led to, I guess, the lack of awareness of clinical trials up until this stage? Why is it only people like yourself with that insider knowledge, and not only, but why are we hearing stories of people with that insider knowledge saying that they knew to put their hand up, not that people were coming to them?
When you're diagnosed with a serious illness, such as cancer, it's all new. Most people have never been in the health system the way they need to be when they've got cancer. And so everything feels overwhelming. You're trying to hear all the different treatment options that have been recommended for you. You've got family and friends talking to you. You might hear stories of your neighbours or the people that, you know, you play sport with, etc. It's overwhelming. And what we want to be able to do is help people with those key questions. What are the key things I need to ask in all of that sort of blur that's going to help me know what's best for me?
Well, as we heard right at the very beginning of today's program, only 6% of current cancer patients are a part of a clinical trial. And our two Australians of the Year want to increase that number and they want to see those numbers of clinical trials go up.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Devising this world-first experimental treatment for my type of brain cancer was bold. For me, the decision to take on Georgina's groundbreaking plan was a no-brainer. Here was an opportunity for us to crack another incurable cancer and make a difference. If not for me, then for others.
We are extremely proud that the data we have generated from this fearless approach is already changing the field. Human clinical trials now look set to follow, and the sooner the better.
And a warm welcome to The Conversation, our Australian, co-Australian of the Year, Professor Georgina Long, co-medical director of the Melanoma Institute of Australia. Georgina, I was shocked, as was Nick, and I think many people listening, to hear that only 6% of current cancer patients are a part of a clinical trial. How do we get that number up, do you believe?
This is a wonderful topic, and I'm so pleased that you're having a whole hour discussion about it. What we need to do, clinical trials are critical. The first thing is, how do we change practice? It's always clinical trials. That's how we make changes and how we improve outcomes. We've got so far in the last many decades, actually, because of clinical trials. So when people think, oh, I've got this treatment for this condition and it works really well, they're all based on clinical trials that have preceded it. So how do we increase that number, or how do we make clinical trials just part of medical practice? And that's to embed it into our clinical care. And that starts right at medical school. Medical school, we learn about evidence, and we have to be evidence-based as doctors. We have to do things that are based with science and that have proof. And we don't just participate and learn about the evidence. We need to actually create the evidence as doctors. So it's that extra bit of learning and understanding. It's not something that's delivered to us as doctors. We actually help create it. And so embedding that thinking into your everyday clinical care is the way to improve those numbers, so that when a person walks through your door, no matter what their condition is, the first thing is, well, what are the available treatments? How effective are they? And sometimes we have things that are 100% effective. We don't need to improve upon them. Things in cancer usually aren't, especially when you've got advanced stage cancer. We need to improve survival rates. So the first thing we should be thinking as a medical profession is, well, what's the evidence and what needs to change? And what's my role in making that change? It's just part of clinical care.
So, Georgina, to flip that, when do the patients get brought in on this? When do we start kind of discussing it with them, start talking about them, start giving them their understanding of what a clinical trial could mean?
I think it's a whole society thing. It's a whole thinking about what is science and how we make change in general. I know this is a really big picture view, but the World Wide Web, that's based on science for all its pros and cons. But it's how we think about all of the things in our lives. But now drilling down to the patient or the person in front of you, they're a participant in this. This is a team effort. People I see, most people, they want to improve outcomes for themselves and they want to improve outcomes for the generation below them as well.
And this is so something that, Danielle, you were saying you benefited from clinical, you weren't a part of a clinical trial yourself, but you benefited from previous clinical trials.
That's absolutely right. And I was first diagnosed with melanoma in 2014. And at that time, those trials were going on. I didn't need to have any treatment other than surgery at that time. But then, you know, 7 years later, here I am benefiting from the people who were enrolled in those trials all those years ago.
Georgina, there's lots of questions around, well, is it one or the other? Is it a clinical trial versus chemo? And you know, why would you not stick with something that we know works as well as it can, like radiation or more inadverted commas, traditional treatments? Are clinical trials seen as a last resort as opposed to a part of your treatment?
Clinical trials vary. That's the first thing to say. There are some clinical trials which we call phase three clinical trials, where what we are trying to do is establish this novel or new way of doing things against the current standard. And they're called randomized phase three trials. So that's one type of trial where you're actually trying something that has been through a process, is known to be safe, is known to have a signal of activity, and we're now doing the last plank of the proof finding, and that is comparing it to the current gold standard. So sure, a standard might be chemotherapy for some cancers, definitely not melanoma. It's not a standard for melanoma at all, but for some cancers. But if you still have a significant death rate from that cancer, there's work to be done. And unless we have some test to say you're going to be in the X percent, let's say it's 20% who do really well with this treatment long term, we need to make improvements above that 20%. And so a phase three trial, for example, would be trying a treatment that's been worked up that we know there's a signal there, and then we're comparing it to the current gold standard. And that's how we make improvements, and that is how someone like Danielle has benefited from immunotherapies. It had to go through those that process before it became available for every Australian, and good reason too. As an Australian who pays a lot of tax, and I'm proud to pay a lot of tax, I think that's wonderful. It invests in our community. I don't want our taxpayers' money spent on treatments that haven't gone through that proof finding. How do we know the harm and benefit of them until they've gone through that process? So it's a very important process that as a community we should uphold and be very happy we've got this system.
Professor Georgina Long, I want to widen the conversation around accessibility. Just for a moment, though, Chris has called in from Leongatha. Chris, you are on a clinical trial in a rural area.
No, I've actually come off it now, but I was on it for 4 years. It was interesting to just hear the talk about the stage three randomised, because that's the type of trial I was on for my prostate cancer, and I felt very supported all the way through. My cancer journey was a long one. I was first diagnosed in 1996.
Chris,
I had surgery, then I had chemotherapy, then I had the radiation therapy, and then finally the wonderful doctors, oncologists that were looking after me said, look, we've got this new trial coming up, and we really think you would benefit from it. But they also went to that extra point of explaining that it's not just about me, it was the results of the information and the extra data that they could get from people being on this clinical trial that would then benefit other
people.
The
long-term impacts of that.
Yeah.
Chris, was it hard to do in a regional area? What did it actually involve?
Well, it involved once a month, I had a two-hour drive into Monash Hospital.
Right.
And then I was there for about 2 or 3 hours having the treatment, and then I'd drive home again. But the drug company, which actually I can't remember their name, but the drug company that was sponsoring this trial, they were able to reimburse me my travel expenses. So really, the contribution and the, I wouldn't call it a difficulty, but I only had to do the transport, get on the bus and...
Well, that's it. There's all of those when we talk about access to it. It's not necessarily being invited to be a part of a clinical trial. It's physically being able to get to it. We know how busy you are, so we thank you for your time today, Professor Georgina Long, co-Australian of the Year, co-medical director of the Melanoma Institute. Thank you for starting today's conversation. And again, hand on heart, congratulations on the work that we're doing. Couldn't think of a better of Australian of the Year, the two of you, to be able to get this message across. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure to speak something about I'm so passionate about, to make a difference to all Aussies, so thank you.
So many texts on this. It says, thank you for this program today. It's helped me. I was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer last year. It gives me hope, and I will now ask more questions. That's from Dale. Also in the studio with you, Dr. Deshaun Hayrath. We haven't let you get a word in yet, Deshaun, so apologies. The head of cancer services at Western Health. I'm not joking. The moment we said the words clinical trials, we had a full board of calls wanting to share their experience. As someone that works within cancer services, and you work from a really widespread sort of multicultural community as well, how misunderstood is the term clinical trial?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's actually quite a few of our patients who have a very good understanding of what that we're talking about. And part of that is because there are resources out there like the Cancer Council website. And we often, when people are diagnosed, we put them in touch with the Cancer Council. But there's others who will, you know, other patients who have much less understanding and are concerned about some of the things that have been raised, like, does this mean that they're going to be experimenting on me, that there's no possibility of hope? You know, for the future.
Can you be a part of a clinical trial? Sorry, I've got 10,000 questions on this. Can you be a part of a clinical trial and still have, inverted commas, traditional treatment? Can you be on chemotherapy or radiation and be a part of a clinical trial?
Yeah, absolutely. So many of the trials, and some of the ones, you know, the phase threes that Georgina was talking about, are ones where we're testing a standard treatment that already exists. And in some cases, we're adding a new treatment on top of that. So it might be chemotherapy together with immune therapy to boost the immune system.
Disharmad, had a few texts in sort of saying, don't forget, trials are just trials. You know, not all trials offer benefit. You need to consider very carefully whether you want to be experimented on. Yep. Does that go to some of the misinformation or some of the, I guess, the confusion necessarily?
Look, I think it's a very valid question for people to ask. I mean, good. You know, the... we go through a process called informed consent, where people have to be given information about the trial. They have to have a discussion and also have written information. And, you know, speaking about the community that I work in the West, you also have to consider their ability to read English and, you know, do you need interpreters? Do you need to support them through that process? And these are very appropriate questions for patients to ask, I think. And the other thing that, you know, people may not understand is when you sign a consent form, you're not signing a contract that says, I have agreed to participate, you know, and I'm locked in for the next 3 years. That is giving permission, and you can withdraw that permission at any time and stop your participation.
The other question for either Deshaun or Danielle, one of the big ones that's coming through, what if you're on a placebo? Is a placebo part of a clinical trial?
Absolutely it is. And again, that's part of the informed consent process. So, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes it'll be a existing treatment plus a placebo. And so why would we do that? You might ask, isn't that a crazy thing to do, to put people on a placebo? And the reason that we do it that way is that we actually know that if people are on placebos and they think they're getting treatment, they do better. So if we're comparing a new treatment to an existing treatment, where the new treatment is, say, chemo plus a new drug, when we're doing what's called the standard arm, which is the chemo arm, the reason we add the placebo to it as well is so that they don't know which treatment they're receiving, because there'll actually be a psychological impact.
Wow.
But all of that goes through ethical review, you know, there's processes to protect
patients. Do you ever find out at the end?
Yes.
I guess you would.
Yes, yes, at the end.
You do? Wow.
Yeah.
Denise is in Paran. Good morning.
Oh, hello. Look, I was just on my way to Cabrini to help a friend who's having breast cancer radiation, but I myself have ovarian cancer, stage 3. I was diagnosed last June, and I've had chemo and operation, and I'm currently on Avastin, but I am going to go on a clinical trial.
And how was that raised with you, Denise? Did you ask the question, or was it something that was brought up with you with your surgeons and with your specialists?
When I first filled some information in with Cabrini, there was a box to tick about clinical trials, and I ticked it. And then my oncologist, Professor Yolande Antill at Cabrini, suggested at last appointment. So I think a lot of it's to do with molecular and DNA, and it's going to target, I think, my particular clear cell cancer.
Oh, Denise, we wish you all the best with it, and we wish your friend all the best as well. What a great friend you are to go in, because you need that company, don't you? Especially when you're sitting in the chair sometimes for hours on end. So,
yeah, it is lovely. So I'm all for the clinical trial. I learning a lot about it, but I was so excited to hear you on the radio talking about it.
Denise, we wish you and your friend all the best. Danielle, do you need to be like Denise? You need to have ticked the box, but then you need to have the right set of circumstances. You know, I hate to say this, but the right type of cancer, the right type of DNA, possibly the right gender in order to be eligible for a clinical trial?
The eligibility criteria is usually very strict, especially in the type of clinical trials we're seeing now, where they're really testing a particular molecular part of a cancer to see if a drug treatment can work. But there are other types of clinical trials as well, and we really focus on the treatment clinical trials, the drug treatments, but there are clinical trials to help you get through cancer as well. So there might be what we call supportive care trials.
Oh, wow.
And they're trials that might test mental health and wellbeing support. It might be a trial to try and improve symptoms. So for someone who had lung cancer, there was a trial around breathlessness, which is a really difficult symptom for someone on lung cancer. And so we can give people this extra support through clinical trials. So it's part of that demystifying what a trial is. A trial can be something that's testing a treatment that can give you a quality of life, and it can also be something that's testing a treatment that can just improve your well-being. So we've got to focus on that as well. And that's why we've got to ask the questions. What trials are around?
What trials are around and where can you get them? Rob Fair is a rural doctor. He's also the immediate past president of the Rural Doctors Association. Rob, a text that came in quite early, it just simply reads, while we're talking about clinical trials, I was disqualified as I couldn't attend regular sessions in the CBD. I live 2 hours out of Melbourne. It seems like if you are not in that CBD, getting the access can be a major challenge.
That's spot on. So this is about less access, worse health outcomes, and also lower health literacy in general for a lot of our rural patients. And you know, it's about health equity. So really what we'd like to see and really what we expect is study design to take account of these factors, and study designs must aim to include rural patients, take into consideration travel and accommodation costs, and make sure that the follow-up is actually accessible to rural patients who really want to be included and have these opportunities that the metro patients have.
So, Rob, is it more about giving travel and accommodation access to people that are living in regional and rural Victoria to come to Melbourne, or is it a bigger and wider lens than that, in that we need to encourage more specialists and clinical trials and more funding into our regional hospitals so that the clinical trials can actually happen in regional Victoria?
Well, I guess if you're going to go back to the rural basics, it's about access to primary health care so people can actually be assessed and appropriately investigated and screened and have symptoms actually picked up on, and then they will be referred in the first instance and then appropriately worked up. So I guess what else would help? Really good quality information about how clinical trials work in accessible language. We're sure that our patients could benefit greatly from this, and it would improve their understanding of how the very complex world of medicine works.
Rob, I'm kind of interested, just with you having your doctor hat on, not necessarily a rural doctor hat, how do you talk to a patient about a clinical trial? How do you start having that conversation?
Well, it really depends very much on the health literacy background of the patient and the personal health beliefs. So you really just have to go right back to their most fundamental health beliefs and how aggressively they want to pursue treatment. They may have other priorities in their life which might not include treatment. So sometimes the idea of taking part in a trial might be a distraction from other much more pressing issues. So you really have to just see it in a holistic way.
Deshaun, that idea of what Rob's talking about of inaccessible language, is that something that you work hard on and that you think is important?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, and it's why the informed consent process is not just about handing over a document so that we have these documents called patient-informed consent forms. So they're handed over to patients, but they've got a lot of legal language and things. So it has to also be a conversation. That's like a reference document. But informed consent is not just about handing it over, saying, have a look at this, let me know what you think.
Because that's frightening and it's confronting.
Absolutely. Yeah. To the point Rob was making, you really need to think about how the patients want information presented to them. You have to understand, what sort of, are they a facts and figures person? Are they more a big picture person?
You're not taking information in clearly, right?
That is so correct.
Your point of diagnosis.
Well, Deshaun, is there enough work being done to make sure that when we talk accessibility, it's not excluding people from culturally and linguistic diverse communities?
So it's interesting. This would be a good thing for Danielle to comment on, because we certainly have concerns about that. But Cancer Council Victoria have done a lot of work to assist us. There's another group called the VCCC Alliance, the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre Alliance, that we work with to help translate information, create fact sheets, really help with that sort of initial step of making patients who might have low English literacy aware of clinical trials as a concept and the general ideas.
Is that something that a lot more work needs to be done, Danielle?
There's a lot of advocacy around that Cancer Council is leading about how do we improve access to clinical trials. We talk about 6% of cancer patients accessing trials, but if we actually drill down into priority populations, we would see that number being, close to zero for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and probably not that much higher for people who don't have English as a first language. There are cultural ways that we have to talk to people about treatment, and those big, complex consent forms that Dish is talking about. It takes a lot for someone to read through that. And often people just want to get started. They're anxious. They think that I've got to start treatment tomorrow. So how we can change those complex forms to be in plain language so we can translate them. But it's difficult because if it's a pharmaceutical study, for example, and they're a sponsor, they've got to put everything in there.
Oh, I want to get into that and the role of pharmaceutical sponsors in just a tick.
We do, but Rob Fair, before I let you go, a few people saying, is there enough support for regional hospitals? Is there enough funding there to make sure that they can be a part of these clinical trials successfully? We know there's been a lot of concern about, the state of regional and rural health, especially around Victoria.
It's an entirely justified concern, and unfortunately I don't have ready access to the details about funding, but we know that much more work needs to be done. One bright light I would mention is that we have actually got the Victorian Department of Health Coordinating Office for Clinical Trial Research coming to our Victorian Rural Health Conference in Mildura this year, and they'll be presenting on the topic of clinical trial and teletrials in Victoria. And so that's a rare opportunity to actually speak to, in depth with the department about how they organise these clinical trials in rural areas and advocate for our health services.
As you do so well. Dr. Rob Fair, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Rob, it's great that you talked about teletrials, because I think it's really important that people who are being treated rurally and regionally know that we do now have, even though it's an emerging area, we do have connection for rural regional hospitals with the big metro hospitals to be able to run what we call a telehealth trial. And that means that someone can stay in their regional area, have their treatment, but be connected to a major hospital that's running that trial. I'd really encourage people who are being treated rurally to still have a conversation about a clinical trial, because hopefully it isn't, as your earlier caller talked about, having to drive to Melbourne now for 2 hours, that we can have more of these telehealth trials available for rural patients.
Dr. Rob Fair, Media Past President of Rural Doctors and a local GP in regional Victoria, as always, thank you so much. We're going to try and get through all of your calls in just a moment. There's a text here from Lucy that says, I've just finished radiotherapy for breast cancer on Monday. I used to work for the Cancer Council of Victoria. I'm now at Barwon Health. I used to share a house with Dr. Dish. Say hi from Lucy.
Hi.
You never know who's listening.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunty with you in Melbourne. Nick Healy, your co-host this morning, joining you from ABC Shepparton. Kate in Eltham has sent us a message, and we're going to get into that with our two guests in just a moment. It says, clinical trials that are sponsored by drug companies are very well funded and able to reimburse people for things like travel and accommodation. Clinical trials that are done in-house by hospitals and universities don't have that kind of funding, and patients are expected to fend for themselves. There needs to be much more government funding for clinical trials that is done by universities as well. Mark's called through. He's in Geelong. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer just over 4 years ago, and I've had 2 years of standard chemotherapy, and after that I was offered a place in the clinical trial at the Austin Hospital. So for the 2 years after my chemo, I travelled up to the Austin monthly to have my infusion, which is part of the clinical trial. It was an immunotherapy clinical trial, and I was I achieved a great benefit from it. I think I've got some side effects that have developed since then, but I'm going fine, and that's 4 years after my diagnosis. I can't speak highly enough of clinical trials. They're absolutely fantastic. They're an opportunity for cancer patients.
Oh, that's good to hear, Mark.
Mark, thank you very much for calling in. We'll go to Merle, who's in Ballarat. Merle, you're in a double-blind testing at the moment.
Yes, I'm in not a cancer trial, but a shoulder surgery trial.
And how's it going for you?
Oh, good. My physio told me that there is some uncertainty about how to treat badly torn tendons in the shoulder. And some people think you should just have physio. Some people think surgery is the way to go. So I don't know what has been done to me. It's a double-blind trial.
Yeah, right. And was it a no-brainer for you, Merle? Did you just sign up for this? Absolutely. Or did you have concerns and questions?
No, because of what my physio said, obviously there is no one way, and if I can be part of a trial where other people will have the best, the most effective treatment, that's the best. But I found out about this only by asking around who was the best shoulder surgery.
Gosh, that's a common thread, Nick, isn't it? I only found out about it because I knew to ask.
It is, and I'm really glad Mel called in because I think it's great to talk about the breadth of some of these clinical trials, not just in cancer situations. Pierre in Ascot Vale. Pierre, good morning.
Good morning.
You're on a clinical trial at the moment, is that right?
Yes, at the tail end of it. I've got a cancer that's called neuroendocrine tumours, and I've had two surgeries over 5 years, and then I had hormone therapy that didn't seem to control the tumours. And then they put me on what's called a safety clinical trial where they're combining two existing treatments and testing their safety given different dosage rates. And I've done the treatment cycles, and the result of it has been that the tumours have shrunk, and now I'm in a monitoring stage where they're just taking scans to see whether the tumours are
that's good news, Pierre.
It's excellent news.
And Pierre, it's a complex trial you've been on, but has the experience been good of the whole trial? Obviously, what you're getting out of it has been good, but what's it been like in terms of the communication?
It's at Peter Mac, and they've been excellent. They originally offered me the trial, and there's a team of doctors and project people who contact me regularly and provide me with good information and good support.
Amazing.
So I can't speak more highly than Peter Mac.
I think everybody does. Oh, Pierre, we wish you all the best.
Yeah.
Danielle Spence, the head of Strategy and Support Division of Cancer Council Victoria, is with you, as is Dr. Deshaun Hayrath, who is the head of Cancer Services at Western Health. Let's talk funding, where the money comes from, where we want more money to come from, and even which types of cancer are funded, because there's a text here that says, look, I know that you want to be upbeat, but what about those difficult cancers to treat? It always seems to be a concentration on the headline cancers, and not all cancers are considered equal. So when we talk about funding, there's the type of cancer that is funded for a clinical trial, and then there's where the money is coming from, and then there might be concerns from people that if it's a pharmaceutical company, if it's a drug company, then what are their interests there? Is it long-term profit or is it health outcomes for an individual? So I don't know, I've just thrown 10,000 questions at you there.
So maybe we'll start with the pharmaceutical company conflict of interest one, because I think that's a really important one. So, of course, pharmaceutical companies want to make money, and they also want their drugs to be successful, so for the outcomes of the clinical trial to be a success. So, you know, I think you can say there's certainly a conflict of interest. So how do we manage that? What is the way in which patients are protected because they need to be. And there's really multiple layers of protection. So hospitals have ethics committees that review what's called a trial protocol, which is the document that outlines how the trial is done, the doses that are used, the monitoring process, but also what the purpose of the trial is. So there's an ethics committee. There's also what's called a research office, a governance office. And then above that, there's other organisations that do monitoring, such as the Therapeutic Goods Administration. There's also a new framework that's been introduced called the National Clinical Trials Governance Framework. So there are multiple layers of protection, but I think, again, I would say to people, ask these questions. You know, why should any patient take this at face value? I think it's, if you have concerns, ask your doctor, ask the people involved about your concerns.
So the other side of one of Rochelle's questions,
the 10,000 questions.
And maybe for you, Danielle, do we need better funding for the trials who aren't being held by pharmaceutical companies?
There are investigator-led studies, and that's often groups of specialists that come together and want to test a new treatment, and they do rely on a different funding stream. And I think that is complex because you had a caller earlier who said that that doesn't always mean that some of your additional costs of travel, et cetera, might be covered. But we know that we want to see more trials in the type of cancers that don't have good outcomes, and that's really important. We've got to see more trials in the rarer cancers, and it's harder.
But if only 6% of cancer patients are currently a part of a trial, you would be thinking, I'm just guessing here, that they're the bigger well-known cancers.
And that's where it's difficult because the bigger well-known cancers have more patients that a drug company can test a trial in. So when you're talking about rare cancers, smaller numbers of people, and if you're testing a molecular component of a cancer that not everyone has, all of a sudden you've got much smaller numbers. So that is why it
is
harder.
Does that make outcomes better, though, or more accurate if you've got a smaller pool of people?
So I think that's also a good question. It does if you can get enough people in that pool for testing, and sometimes that will involve a worldwide population of patients with a rare mutation. And I think I'd like to say something else about this, which is to some extent, you know, the cancer sector and cancer treatment is a victim of its own success. When I was a young oncologist, starting out my training, we really just had chemotherapy and some hormone treatments available. There were a few chemo drugs. But then since then, and really as Georgina Long said, as a result of clinical trials, you know, there's now immune therapy available. There's targeted therapies. And targeted therapies mean that you test the patient's cancer for specific abnormalities and target those abnormalities rather than the shotgun approach of chemo. So it's actually what has happened is cancer treatment has become really specialised down to this mutation level. It means when you're doing new clinical trials, you're actually testing a really, it's not just breast cancer, it's this, you know, subgroup of breast cancer. So even with the common breast cancers.
Yeah, it's narrow.
And I think that is not the only factor, but that's one of the factors why we haven't got above that 6% level.
Dr. Dish, and a very big thank you to Lucy for letting us know that nickname.
Best
I'm very,
name
very
ever.
Fond of it. I love it completely. We've had a text in, Keith Wilkins, who says he's an ex-ethics committee secretary, saying that when it comes to consent and freedom withdrawal, some trials it may be harmful to stop participating due to the nature of the therapy.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's incredibly important that informed consent takes in some of those consequences.
It does. I think that is a pretty rare situation, though, to be honest, that withdrawal leads to danger. I don't disagree with that. I think that what would happen in practice is if you drew from a trial, there's an ethical obligation for the staff involved in your care to continue to monitor you and to be aware of the treatments that you've had and the potential side effects and the potential long-term complications, regardless of whether you're still participating in the trial or not.
Let's continue the ethics conversation. Dr. Ian Pieper is the Chair of Human Research Ethics Committee at the University of Canberra. And when we talk about the ethics here, Ian, it's something that we've discussed right from the very beginning. Ethics is a broad term, right? Because everybody has individual ethics and every company, every organisation, every volunteer group have their own ethics as well. How do you perceive a clinical trial to be done ethically?
Well, that's a great question because every trial is different and every person is different, and everyone's reason for joining a clinical trial is different. The Australian process is based largely on the National Statement on Ethical Conduct in Human Research, which is a document that's put out by the National Health and Medical Research Council. And that document sets out what the ethical conduct of research looks like. And so when an application comes before an ethics committee, the basis of that discussion is founded on the principles of the National Statement. And they look at what are the risks to individuals and to communities and to the researchers themselves, and they look at what benefits might come from the research.
Mm. I find risks interesting and individual, right? Because, and this is maybe something you can speak to, Danielle, about a personal level. If you are given a diagnosis, if you are given a terminal diagnosis or a very slim chance of living, then the individual's definition of risk is going to differ, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And if people have exhausted all of their treatment and they're having a discussion about perhaps a phase one clinical trial, which is not a trial that is going to potentially save their life, it's not going to save their life, that they'll have different reasons for thinking about that. And it might be to try and improve symptoms, but there's also that altruism that some people have, that they want to do something for others coming after them. So everyone has different reasons for what treatment they accept or the clinical trials that they might decide that they want to be enrolled in. And that's why it's important to have that really good relationship with your specialist so that you feel comfortable to be able to have that conversation. And sometimes it's good to talk to someone else that's had a clinical trial experience. And at Cancer Council, we have trained volunteers who have been involved in clinical trials, and they can talk to people who might call us through 13 11 20, our information support line, and have that conversation and ask the sorts of questions that perhaps they're not quite ready to ask their specialist yet.
Dr. Ian Pieper, thank you so much for your insights into that, because when we talk about ethics, this, as we said, it's really individual. We don't have a lot of time, and again, I've still got 10,000 questions. Dr. Dish, I want to put to you, and this is something that Professor Georgina Long mentioned right at the beginning of the program, and you was talking about being an early oncologist, in the beginning of your years. Do we need to start to introduce clinical trials at medical school? How much of a difference would that make?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think what Georgina was alluding to is really not so much introducing the trials to the medical students, but introduce the way of thinking, that critical way of thinking, and that sense that, in having clinical trials as part should be part of standard care. And so I think that is absolutely right, that part of it should happen.
Going to another call quickly, Greg is in Ballarat. Greg, you're on a clinical trial. What's happening at the moment, Greg?
Yes, I'm on a trial. In fact, I've just left the Alfred now, and I've been on the clinical trial for prostate cancer for 14 months, and it's been failing the last 2 months. But my question really is, where do we actually go now? I've gone through the surgery and a whole range of other treatments, but it's sort of getting towards the bottom end of what can or can't be done. So I'm looking to explore, where do you go with getting information about other clinical trials that might be the stage, a phase three trial?
Danielle?
We have at Cancer Council a website that's called the Victorian Clinical Trial Link. There are 400 clinical trials there. You can put in different words. You can put prostate cancer in, stage 4 prostate cancer. Different trials will pop up. There'll be links to people you can talk to about that trial. But also you can take that information back to your specialist and say, well, hey, what about this trial?
This one and that one.
It might not be a trial that you're eligible for, but at least it's going to get the conversation going around what's possible. So you can have a look at trials. cancervic.org.au or call the Cancer Council on 13 11 20.
Greg, we wish you all the best, and we hope that we do find another stage 3 trial. Let's quickly try and squeeze in Meg, who's in Riverland. Hi, Meg.
Hi, I've been diagnosed with amyloid carcinoma. It's actually taken my eyesight, and I'm just wondering if there are any clinical trials around.
Well, again, I wonder if, Meg, if that's something that to pop into the Cancer Council's website. I didn't realise there were so many different types of trials there. Can we just give that website again so that people like Meg and anyone else listening, Danielle, know where to go?
So it's the Victorian Clinical Trials link. You can just go to Cancer Council's website, or you can type into your search engine trials.cancervic.org.au, or you can ring 13 11 20, speak to our experienced cancer nurses, and they can help you connecting to that website.
Just finally, I'll put to you, Dish, are you confident that the numbers will rise of clinical trials, that they'll become more accessible?
I think we have work to do, to be honest, in that area for some of the reasons I've said. But look, there's certainly opportunities for us to expand in areas that have low activity in clinical trials, like palliative care, radiation. There's probably room in surgical trials. So yes, there's it could happen, but it is going to take an effort, and frankly, it should be an effort by the Australian community. I don't think it's...
So is it if we demand them more, like if we ask more questions, will that create change, do you think?
Look, I think that, as others have alluded to, some of this comes from pharma money, but others will be from government funding, and government priorities will really follow, you know, what voters want, what people want.
Danielle Spence, the Head of Strategy Support Division at the Cancer Council, thank you so much for your time today. Lovely to meet you face-to-face. We've spoken many times on the
thanks,
phone.
Thanks, Rochelle.
But lovely to have you in the studio. And can we call you Dr. Dish?
Everyone does.
Dr. Dishan Hayrath, the Head of Cancer Services at Western Health. Thank you so much for your time and for all of the work that you do. We really appreciate it. Don't forget, The Conversation Hour is also a podcast, and we've done lots of different programs, whether it be on different types of cancers and different types of treatments, or if you've missed the beginning of today's show, you want to share it with someone that's curious about a clinical trial, then go to the ABC Listen app and subscribe to The Conversation Hour, and you can share this show far and wide. As always, Nick Healy, thanks so much, mate. I'll speak to you next week.
You will.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.